From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in while Terry Gross is on vacation. In northern Iraq, the Kurds are fighting to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government. In Turkey, there's a long history of conflict between the Turks and the ethnic Kurds. On this edition of Fresh Air, we get a primer on Kurdish history with anthropologist Bill Beeman. Also today, Ron Graham shares his three great loves: mathematics, juggling, and plugging vegetables into wall sockets. And rock historian Ed Ward reminds us that not everything on the Beatles' record label was a hit. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney predicted today that the decline of the Soviet Union will continue unless leaders there return to the course of reform. Cheney made his gloomy assessments before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Cheney, who has long been one of the most pessimistic Bush administration officials on Soviet reform prospects, told the panel the Soviet central government, led by President Mikhail Gorbachev, has abandoned its economic reform efforts. Cheney warned that the resulting Soviet decline may affect surrounding countries.
Growing unrest and violence in the Soviet Union would threaten its neighbors in Central and Eastern Europe, since some of the turmoil may well spill over the borders of the Soviet Union itself.
Cheney said while prospects for arms control with the Soviets are in doubt, he noted that the Soviets are pulling their troops from Eastern Europe on schedule. That, he says, makes him feel relaxed about American military reductions in the region. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Two co-defendants of deposed Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega were convicted today of drug trafficking. Brian Davido and William Saldarriaga were the first of Noriega's co-defendants to go on trial. They were convicted on two counts each of conspiracy and drug charges arising from a 1986 attempt to smuggle cocaine from Colombia to the U.S. aboard a luxury yacht. According to the prosecution, the cocaine was obtained in exchange for U.S.-made automatic rifles provided by Noriega. A government witness said that Noriega was to share in the profits from the deal. Colombian drug traffickers have threatened to kill two journalists they're holding hostage and set off 500-pound bombs in major cities. The traffickers also claim to be at war with self-defense and paramilitary groups in the countryside. Leslie Werpsa reports from Medellin.
Calling themselves the Extraditables, the drug traffickers said they will set off a bomb every time Colombian authorities torture or kill one of their members. In a communique published in the local press today, the extraditables threatened to kill journalists Francisco Santos and Maruja Pachon if disappearances of their cohorts continue. Two other hostages have already been killed. The traffickers also confirmed that they have had a falling out with paramilitary organizations that used to be under their command in the countryside. They claimed responsibility for the recent murders of paramilitary chiefs in the central Magdalena Valley. The new round of threats comes just days after a private lawyers association asked the Constitutional Assembly to grant the traffickers and their hitmen full pardon for all crimes. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Medellin.
Stock prices dropped more than 2% today on Wall Street after computer giant IBM said it's expecting sharply lower first-quarter earnings. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 62 points to close at 2,867.8. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1 in active trading. Volume was 177 million shares. This is NPR. The Michigan State Senate has approved a bill that would outlaw assisted suicides. The measure would make it a felony to help anyone commit suicide. It's aimed at people like Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who provided a so-called suicide machine to help an Alzheimer's disease victim take her own life last June. Critics of the bill have argued that it's too broad and doesn't meet any pressing need. Supporters note that 27 other states have laws against assisted suicide. The bill goes on to an uncertain future in the state house. The Senate Banking and Urban Affairs Committee today began examining the social and economic barriers facing young black males in the country's urban areas. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
Committee Chairman Senator Don Riegel says it's both an economic and a moral problem for America when the black unemployment rate stands at 19% nationally, more than double the rate for whites. The committee heard testimony from black social and political leaders, including Virginia Governor Doug Wilder, who spoke of a disappearing generation of young black males.
Few are found in jobs with a promising future. Few are found at the head of families that they father. Every day we still find more hiding behind crack, alcohol, and crime, or lying on a table in the local morgue.
Wilder called on Congress to take steps to open up the job market, narrow the income-earning gap, and to pass a civil rights bill. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
South Africa's government freed 40 political prisoners today under the terms of an agreement with the African National Congress. The amnesty was extended to prisoners across the political spectrum and included a right-wing anti-apartheid activist as well as members of the ANC. The release was welcomed by the ANC, but leaders of the group complained that the government was slow in keeping its amnesty pledge. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Earlier today, Iranian press reports said that Kurdish rebels had taken control of much of northeastern Iraq, including the important oil city Kirkuk. Saddam Hussein is apparently now turning his forces against the Kurds, but he'll likely have a tough fight of it. The Kurds are spread out through the mountains of Turkey, Iran, Syria, and they make up about a third of Iraq itself. They are among the oldest and fiercest peoples of the Mideast, some 16 million who have their own language and culture dating back some 2,500 years, but still have no nation to call their own. Originally a mountain people, they are mostly Sunni Muslims, who, according to legend, are descendants of 400 virgins who were raped by devils on the way to King Solomon's court. At the end of the Crusades, it was a Kurdish warrior, Saladin, who brought back Jerusalem to Muslim hands. Today, few Americans know anything of the Kurds beyond the fact that Saddam Hussein used poison gas to suppress their rebellion in 1988. But journalist and anthropologist Bill Beeman, who spent a decade in the Middle East, says that the Kurds have long been at the crossroads of Middle Eastern conflict. And if it turns out that they are able to hold on to Iraq's most valuable resource, the northern oil fields, they will pose a very serious threat to Saddam.
If the Kurds were able to hold and keep the city of Kirkuk, they could essentially be determining the economic future of Iraq, if Iraq holds together as a country altogether, after all. Another thing that's very important is that the Kurdish resistance movement in Iraq has long been supported by Iran. And so, therefore, a takeover by Kurdish forces in northern Iraq may also mean an incursion by Iran into the present resistance against Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Well, there's also a U.S. role in this exchange with Iraq and Iran, isn't there? We were to some degree also supporting the Kurdish rebels, weren't we?
Yes, we were, and in particular in this last particular fray, where we were involved with Baghdad, and where we were fighting Saddam Hussein directly, we saw the Kurds as potential troublemakers for Saddam Hussein, and so there was a degree of support for the Kurdish resistance movement coming through Turkey, of course.
There's a phrase that one hears regularly, though, about the Kurds. It's that the Kurds have no friends.
That's right.
Even though we may have been friends, or that the Iranians may have been friends in one moment, or the Iraqis, at root, the Kurds still keep no friends.
That's correct. The Kurds have not been well served by anybody. They've been willing to take aid where they can. Either primarily, however, from outside sources, from Iran. There's been some degree of support for one of the Kurdish groups in the past from Syria and also from Libya. But in general, in the countries in which they live, they are very, very badly treated. The Iranians, of course, under the Shah, were quite suspicious of the Kurds because in 1946, they, in conjunction with the Soviet Union, formed an independent Kurdish republic, the so-called Mahabad Republic. And so the Shah was deeply suspicious of the communist influences that might have taken hold among the Kurds. Of course, Iraq has suppressed the Kurds regularly, and they're fearful that a rebellion there would cut them off from their oil supplies. Turkey has really done the worst of all. many Kurds in Turkey, and they, by the way, that's the largest group of Kurds in the Middle East, don't even know that they are Kurds. They've been called Mountain Turks by the actual Turks for a long time. They've been forbidden to speak their own language, and there really has been a general cultural repression of Kurdish identity in Turkey altogether.
So where are we? I mean, we have these reports that the Kurds may now be presenting the most severe threat to Saddam Hussein's survival as head of Iraq. We see the Iranians conceivably arming both the Kurds and the rebels in the south. Where do you see this playing out? What role can you imagine they may have in the future of Iraq? And just how much do you suppose they can rely upon the Iranians as long as ongoing backers?
There are several degrees to which the Kurds would like to have some degree of independence. There, on the one hand, there are some that press for a totally independent Kurdish state. Now, this would be pretty viable, actually, given the fact that the Kurds sit on so much oil. Nevertheless, they have no industrial infrastructure. They are in Iraq, there are no real large Kurdish cities, and for the most part, the Kurds in Iraq belong to one particular faction of Kurds, one cultural faction, if you like. And this particular faction, the Kurmanji faction, is considered to be rather brave and manly, but nevertheless not as well educated or as able to carry out a statesman-like government. The southern faction, the Sorani faction, are more urban, better educated, but primarily live in Iran. So it's not clear, really, that an independent and autonomous Kurdistan made up of the northern Iraqi territory could really survive as an independent country. Now, a milder version of this that's pressed by a number of the Kurdish resistance groups is that there be a Kurdish autonomous region, but not an independent state. And this is...
Explain what this means. These are people attempting to carve out a life in a mountainous zone. And what do these terms mean?
Well, an independent state would be just that. That is, there'd be total self-determination. There'd be no ties with Baghdad or any other state. They'd make their own foreign relations, and they would essentially be on a tub on its own bottom in trying to pursue their economic future and their cultural future. And as I say, it would be a landlocked country with no outlet to the sea, and they'd be totally dependent on their neighbors for their export of oil because it would all have to go through pipelines. So that would be a very difficult situation to pursue for a state. Other landlocked states, such as Afghanistan, have lots of trouble getting in and out of the region. There's also not very good road transportation into Kurdistan or out of it.
Right. So, and an autonomous region, on the other hand, within Iraq.
Right. An autonomous region within Iraq would be a region that was still tied to the Baghdad government. Nevertheless, Baghdad would still conduct all foreign relations for the entire territory, would probably regulate the general economics of the entire country. But in terms of, let's say, things like education or local economic questions, they would have total autonomy. That is, it would not be governed from Baghdad. And in particular, the Kurds would like, for once, to be able to have education in their own language, because Kurdish is a language. It's not Arabic. It's not Persian. It's not Turkish. It really is a very separate language. It even has a literature, but the difficulty has been that people have not been allowed to speak it or write in it in most countries.
Bill, we were just you were just explaining that the Kurds would the Kurds have long wanted a place of their own, a home of their own, a nation of their own. It doesn't seem too likely they're going to get it right away. But what is it that could happen within that place? Give us a sense. Put some clothes on these people. Who are they? What could happen? Give us some sense of of their language, the tone and texture of what a Kurdish home would be.
Well, Kurds are now, I guess you could say, divided between rather urbanized, modern people who've had a Western-style education. These mostly live in either the large cities of Iraq, like Kirkuk, or in the large cities in Iran, like Sanandaj or Kermanshah, or Rezaieh, which are important Iranian cities in the western part of Iran. The other group of Kurds are still mountain-living tribespeople who are fiercely independent. They have a very rich culture. And they are a reputation for being rather closed off from other ethnic groups in the region. They are crack horsemen, crack shooters. They have a very distinctive ethnic dress, and also, as I've said before, a language which is quite distinct from any language in the region.
We're not talking about an Arab people here, but we are talking about an Islamic people.
That's correct. They're an Islamic people. Interestingly, the Kurds are mostly Sunni, but there are also quite a few Shiite Kurds who live in Iran. And in Turkey, there are a number of Kurds that are allied with the Alevi Bektashi movement, which is another branch, actually, of Shiism, and which has been considered threatening by the Turkish government. So even though they are all Muslims, of course, there are various religious groups represented within the Kurdish community. I think it's fair to say that the Kurds are primarily an ethnic group then, rather than a religious group. And because of their great antiquity as a people, they have a set of traditions that go back thousands of years.
My guest is Bill Beeman, an anthropologist who specialized in Middle Eastern cultures. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Beeman. We've been talking about Kurds in the Middle East and their role in the current conflict between Iraq and its neighbors. And you've spoken about the attempt by the Turkish government to assimilate its Kurdish population.
That's right.
But what's a day in the life of a Kurdish family in Turkey like? What do they see to lose? And what are they attempting to preserve?
If a child, for instance, comes to school in Turkey and speaks Kurdish, the child is likely to be beaten and told that he's not to speak this strange dialect. If a Kurd in Turkey cannot conduct any business at all in Turkey with using Kurdish. The Kurdish names have been forbidden in official records in Turkey, so that there really has been an attempt to try to totally eradicate the Kurdish culture in Turkey per se.
There's a question of loss of language, of how one transacts business. Do we see distinct differences in the family lives within Kurdish communities? Or Turkish or Iraqi, say in marriage rites and rituals or that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Kurdish customs are very distinctive. The Kurds follow a general Middle Eastern marriage pattern. That is that that father's brother's daughter marriage is favored in Kurdistan, as it is in many parts of the Middle East.
Run that by us a little more
sorry.
Clearly.
Cousin marriage, essentially, is favored in Kurdistan, as it is in much of the Middle East. Nevertheless, it is a particularly strong tool in Kurdish life for political alliance between different families and different tribal factions, so that we look at marriage as a very important political tool as well as an important social tool.
And again, there are ceremonies that are reflective of these alliances as well as of the actual marriage itself?
Well, marriage ceremonies, like ceremonies in many parts of the world, celebrate not only the union of two people, but also the cultures from which they come. And a Kurdish marriage ceremony celebrates essentially the Kurdish cultural spirit as well as the union between two families.
How does that happen?
Well, you have first of all, the marriage ceremonies last for many, many days. They are ceremonies when people get their national dress out, including a very specific Kurdish costume. Men in Kurdistan wear a kind of baggy trouser and tunic, and also a very distinctive headdress with a kind of fringe on it. You can't possibly forget a Kurdish man in full dress once you've seen him. It's a very, very distinctive costume. And Kurdish women also have a series of distinctive costumes, which vary a little bit from region to region. It includes full skirts, a jacket and tunic, and also a particular series of headdresses and headbands that are adorned with coins and jewelry of one sort or another. It's modest dress by Islamic standards, but not a veil as we find in Iran or other parts of the country. It's very colorful. Actually, these clothes are worn in Kurdish villages day in and day out on a regular basis. So a wedding consists of oftentimes contests, such as horse riding contests, shooting contests, a lot of dancing, both male and female dancing, good food, and a general celebration of Kurdish life, as well as a celebration of the marriage between two partners.
And those partners, as you say, may even be first cousins, in which you're building an alliance of what, economic importance, or?
That's correct. You're in the marriage between cousins. You're actually consolidating your economic resources in a family. And you're making sure that the economic resources from from an earlier generation stay within one particular line. Now, another kind of marriage could be a marriage outside of the family, and that's almost always done in order to try to gain new relationships with other families or with other tribal groups. So it's an alliance kind of marriage. And that's, as I say, these patterns are not unique to Kurds. They occur throughout the Middle East. But because Kurdish tribal life is so strong, these patterns are very, very common in Kurdistan, especially in the mountainous regions, in a way that they have ceased to become important in urban areas. I should also mention that Kurdish music is one of the finest folk music traditions in the Middle East. It's not very well known in the West, but it is a distinctive tradition. It's not Arabic music and not Persian music at all, but a very distinctive musical form, and it's one thing that the Kurds are especially proud of. And it's very difficult for Kurds in Turkey because they may, in fact, be arrested for singing a Kurdish song in public, and they have been in the past.
I could well imagine that secular leaders who have a vision of modernizing their countries might very well see these sorts of traditional marriages, which are, I presume, alliances really between men in which the women become the point of alliance. They might see these traditions as antithetical to modernizing.
Well, we have to remember that the nations of the region, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, have all been involved in a modern ethic of modernization. The father of modern Turkey, Ataturk, of course, was interested in modernizing his country with a vengeance. And he was interested in eradicating all forms of traditional culture in favor of trying to establish Western industry, Western cultural institutions, and also a Western-style democracy. And this was, and so it is, it's quite understandable, given this extraordinary drive toward modernization, why the present government of Turkey, carrying on in Atatürk's tradition, would want to eradicate these traditional cultures and try to develop a homogeneous national culture for Turkey. I think that's really where it comes from. I think it may not be a drive directed specifically against the Kurds because Turks hate Kurds. It's because the Turks want a homogeneous nation state. And they know that when you have an autonomous cultural region like Kurdistan, that gets in the way of establishing a real Western-style nation state.
Bill, it occurs to me that forces that would like to see modernism and democratic participation might very well run up against these same sorts of problems with their ethnic minorities, be they Kurdish or otherwise. That it isn't only despots who are likely to have these problems, but that it's unclear how ethnic minorities are going to function in what the West likes to call a modern democratic country.
That's right. It is a difficult problem, and I, not to get too far afield, but I should mention that even in the United States, we have the English First movement, which is essentially a way of trying to express our concern with the same problem here in the United States. Now, what do we do if we have an ethnic minority that grows up speaking another language than English as their first language? So this is a problem of essentially state building. But what we have to recognize is that the world really does not consist entirely of nation states. And the nation state question is, I think, going to be increasingly an important one for us. We have places like Turkey, like Iraq, and like Iran, which look outwardly to be nation states. They have governments and parliaments, but on the other hand, they have these very, very important ethnic groups who identify primarily with their ethnicity or with their religion rather than with their adherence to any loyalty to any particular state. And this is, as I say, an enormous problem. Unfortunately, it's been addressed by many of these countries by trying to eradicate these cultural traditions, making the speaking of a language or the singing of a song illegal in order to try to force people to assimilate to some broader cultural tradition, or by gassing them or bombing them when they don't do what the central government wants. This, unfortunately, is not only cruel and really inhuman, but it also does not work in the long run. That is, when you're talking about 16 to 20 million people, you can't really eradicate their culture that easily. Cultures don't die very, very quickly.
My guest has been anthropologist Bill Biebman. He teaches at Brown University and has spent many years in the Middle East. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Frank Browning with Fresh Air. Ron Graham spends his days at the AT&T Bell Labs trying to solve some very difficult problems in mathematics. He spends his weekends working out very difficult problems in juggling or on the trampoline. Coming up, we meet Ron Graham. Also, everyone knows Apple Records was the label the Beatles started. Rock historian Ed Ward plays a few of the label's other artists. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Egypt's official news agency reports that Kuwait's government has resigned 3 weeks after being liberated from Iraq. Crown Prince Sheikh Al-Abdullah Al-Sabah, the Emirate's prime minister, submitted his resignation to the emir today, and the emir asked the outgoing prime minister to form a new government, according to the report. The emir is facing growing demands from Kuwaitis for a return to democracy. He dissolved the country's parliament in 1986, but Kuwaiti leaders have promised to return to the 1962 constitution as soon as possible, and new elections could be held within a year. Iraqi opposition groups say the city of Kirkuk in the north of the country has fallen to Kurdish rebels. Clashes between the Iraqi army and anti-government forces continue, with refugees speaking of horrific conditions in southern Iraq. Gerald Butt in Nicosia reports.
The city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq had been under attack from the rebels for about a week. A spokesman for one of the Kurdish opposition groups said today the city had finally fallen after a massive attack. But the spokesman added that operations were continuing to flush out the remaining loyalist forces. The capture of Kirkuk, if it's confirmed, amounts to a major setback for the Saddam regime. The city lies at the heart of Iraq's northern oil region. In the southern part of Iraq, reports of fighting continue to belie the claim made by President Saddam Hussein last Saturday that Shiite Muslim regions were now calm. Many thousands of civilians are said to have been killed. Tehran Radio quoted one refugee crossing into Iran as saying that the city of Basra was filled with corpses and there was no food or water in the city. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
ABC News quoted a source inside Lebanon's Hezbollah party today, saying that 12 Westerners held hostage in Lebanon could be released very, very soon. ABC's European correspondent, Pierre Salinger, says leaders of Hezbollah, or Party of God, are returning from Tehran, where they met President Ali Akbar Rafsanjani. The State Department says it has not been able to confirm the network's report. Coal strikes are spreading in the Soviet Union, threatening an already shaky economy. Justin Burke has more from Moscow.
Coal strikes are sweeping across the Soviet Union, and they're starting to paralyze other industries. Miners are also mounting a serious political challenge to Mikhail Gorbachev, demanding that the Soviet president resign. The strikes began more than 2 weeks ago and have been gaining momentum ever since. Today, miners walked off the job in the Chelyabinsk region of Siberia and the Arctic area of Arkuta. Almost 100 pits are strike-bound in the key coal-producing areas of the Donbas and the Kuzbas. Government officials have tried to persuade miners to return to work using offers of better food and housing, but strike leaders say they won't be fooled by economic incentives again. They charge the government with not fulfilling promises that ended a 1989 coal strike. For National Public Radio, I'm Justin Burke in Moscow.
On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today by 62 points at 2867.82. This is NPR. The Supreme Court has bolstered protection for unions against lawsuits filed by members who claim unfair or inadequate representation. A suit brought by pilots who struck Continental Airlines was decided in favor of the union. The justices ruled unanimously today that workers who claim they were shortchanged in a labor settlement can only win a suit against their union if they show the union accepted a wholly irrational or arbitrary deal. The suit came from a settlement between Continental and the Airline Pilots Association, ending a 2-year strike. The deal allowed pilots who'd walked out to return to work, but they lost seniority and other favorable conditions. Pilots who continued to work and replacement workers who crossed picket lines were given more favorable conditions. The High Court says such a settlement could be bad for members, but not necessarily unfair. The Senate today approved a bill that would spend $15 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money on the cost of Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Tough language in the bill calls for stopping arms sales to U.S. allies that don't pay their promised share. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
The House approved a war funding measure that included a mild threat that if Allied aid falls short, Congress may consider appropriate action. The bill that passed the Senate today has tougher language. It would halt arms sales to those countries who don't make good on their pledges of assistance. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates would be the hardest hit. They are trying to purchase a total of $19 billion worth of weapons from the U.S. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The U.S. Department of Commerce has issued its 5 millionth patent today. Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher awarded it to University of Florida researchers who have developed a process that turns organic waste into a clean gasoline substitute. The 200th anniversary of the U.S. patent was celebrated last year. The Pentagon has reported new gains by Kurdish insurgents fighting against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in northern Iraq. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When the Beatles started the now-defunct Apple Records back in the late 60s, it wasn't only a vehicle for the group. It was also a place where individual Beatles could indulge their own tastes and excesses. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the albums and the singles they released were an odd collection. Before Ed resurrects some of those, here's something a little more classic from the label.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude.
Apple wasn't the first record label owned by musicians. Afraid. Charles Mingus and Max Roach had run Debut back in the 50s. And when Apple was founded, Frank Sinatra had had Reprise Records going since the start of the decade. But it was the first record label owned by four British lunatics who had nearly all the money in the world and probably ate hallucinogenic drugs for breakfast. That's why, as soon as I read that it was going to happen, I started buying every record Apple put out. Hey Jude was a hit, of course, but that was to be expected. It was the Beatles. But the band had announced that they'd use the label to give deserving artists a chance, as well as to do some side projects each had in mind. The first deserving artist was Jackie Lomax, a fellow Liverpudlian who'd played with a band called The Undertakers. George Harrison wrote a couple of songs for him and produced them, rather badly in my opinion.
If your life's not right, doesn't satisfy you, you don't get the breaks like some of us do.
Harrison must have been the bottled-up Beatle. He took to Apple like crazy. At one point, he flew Paul Beaver and Bernie Krause, two American Moog synthesizer experts, over to London so he could learn the nuances of the machine. They set up a demonstration, and George taped the lesson. Little did Beaver and Krause expect that George would soon release it as an album called Electronic Sounds, under his own name. Of course, there were other things on George's mind, too.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
George wound up producing two singles and an album for the Radha Krishna Temple of London. That was obviously his guitar playing at the beginning of a record that became a standby on vegetarian restaurant jukeboxes everywhere. Actually, I really liked the follow-up, Govinda, which was sort of beatly and catchy. John Lennon, of course, soon began using Apple as a forum for his and Yoko Ono's efforts, starting with Give Peace a Chance by the Plastic Ono Band, the record that some Beatle fans credit with breaking up the Beatles. Occasionally, though, he looked beyond his own concerns, as when the London hippie magazine Oz was busted for obscenity in 1971. Produced by Lennon and Phil Spector and sung by one Bill Elliott, God Save Us was issued as a benefit record for Oz, which folded soon thereafter. Paul McCartney was by this time fairly estranged from the Beatles, although he used Apple for his solo records. Ironically, he brought the first non-Beatle hit to the label in the person of Mary Hopkin, whose Those Were the Days was a solid middle-of-the-road classic. He also delivered a Boston rich kid folkie who did a whole album that flopped.
There's something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. And if I'm feeling down and blue, or troubled by some foolish game, she always seems to make me change my mind.
James Taylor went on to other things, but George Harrison liked the title of that song enough to steal it. George was also still bringing new talent to Apple. One real neglected classic was by none other than Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes.
Way back in time, someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some, I bought some. Whoa, whoa, whoa. After a while, when I had tried them, denied them, I opened my eyes.
Try Some, Buy Some takes forever to get going, so it wasn't a hit, but the production is classic Phil Spector. To balance that out, George also produced Lon and Derek Van Eaton, who for obvious reasons have vanished into the mists of history.
Heaven knows my heart is there, and I work and try my best to bring peace to everyone. The way to help them change their ways, way to have them blessed. Just let them hear our guitars and feel.
But by now it was 1972, and George was about the only Beatle still interested in Apple. He may have been responsible for Chris Hodges' hymn to the Space Brothers, We're On Our Way, but trust me, that's too awful to play. There were only two more records in Apple's future. One, Now or Never by Yoko Ono, had a graphic picture of the My Lai Massacre on its cover, even more gruesome than the music inside. The other was Ringo's sole outside contribution. Saturday Night Special by the Sundown Playboys must have caught Ringo's ear while he was in the States, but at least he saw to it that Apple Records died with a smile on its face.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Coming up, one of Bell Labs' leading scientists tells us how to electrify a pickle. This is Fresh Air. When he was an undergraduate at Berkeley, Ronald Graham organized a performing trampoline team. When he joined Bell Laboratories many years later as one of the world's foremost mathematicians, he did complex juggling and circus acts. Now, working both at Bell Labs and Rutgers University, Ronald Graham is playing with what he calls the electric pickle. In one way or another, the playfulness in everyday life gives Graham occasions to explore the often impenetrable language of mathematics in the midst of everyday life. Right now, for example, he's one of a handful of people who can keep seven balls sailing through the air at the same time.
The very number one juggler in the country now looks like he can do nine balls almost. So There's a tremendous difference as you add each additional ball, but a 7 is definitely challenging, although it's more appreciated by the jugglers. In the performing skills, the circus, for example, you like to do things which look hard but are easy, where for jugglers, they're impressed by things that are truly hard. So 7 balls is quite hard, whether, you're doing it, for example, underwater. I used to try to juggle underwater, the idea being to try to slow down the descent of the ball. So I thought...
Isn't it a little bit hard to propel the ball as well?
Well, it is, but the main difficulty is the turbulence caused in the water by moving your hands up and down. And it's very hard to juggle 3 balls underwater, actually. Although I thought they really missed a great opportunity on the moon. Rather than hit golf balls, they should try to juggle.
You know, I'm thinking about my second year algebra final exam in high school, which I failed. And I'm saying, I have a picture of mathematics, and now I have a picture of juggling 3 balls underwater. And those two pictures are not superimposed yet. I'm not quite there. What does juggling underwater or on the moon have to do with math?
Well, in a fundamental sense, juggling is an attempt to establish some kind of patterns or order in a potentially chaotic situation. Juggling is doing a little more than a rational person should do. Typically, you have 3 balls and 2 hands, or 5 balls or 7 balls. And I think a lot of us live our lives that way, with various things up in the air, and you know they're going to come down pretty soon. You'd like to put a little order into this. And there's a characterization of mathematics as the science of order, the search for patterns in a apparently chaotic situation. And there are a lot of people in mathematics involved in searching out for hidden structure, hidden order in what looks like just a morass of chaos. And that's true not only in mathematics, but in physics and biology and astronomy and many of the sciences. And from the point of view that mathematics is really the language of science, then you see how mathematics permeates a lot of the sciences, and the same philosophy occurs in juggling, where you have patterns, you have specific what are called algorithms or step-by-step procedures for trying to go from one step to the next step.
But now math, you're bringing this down. You're saying that there is a language, that mathematics is really the language of science, and that it is a language which enables us to break complex problems down into simpler components. Let's stay with juggling a moment and see how that works.
Well, when I teach someone to juggle the fundamental juggling pattern with 3 balls, it takes roughly 30 minutes, I would say, to teach people the essentials. But most of the time is spent first with 1 ball, and that's fairly easy, and then with 2 balls. So to the extent that you're breaking down the 3-ball pattern into simpler 1 and 2-ball patterns, that's the same way you might learn some complicated mathematical skill by looking at the various components. That's the essence of mathematics, by mastering basic ideas and building a broad foundation, you can build quite a tall structure.
Well, that doesn't exactly bring us to the electric pickle, but why not? You create electric vegetables.
Well,
what are these things?
Well, I guess I can't really take credit for inventing it, but I certainly have explored it a little bit. But the effect is just very striking. And if you tell someone you should go try it, they'll look at you and say, sure, I should. But the effect is basically this. If you take a large dill pickle, and larger the better in some sense, and put nails at each end of the pickle, and then take a normal electrical outlet, so take a wire, but then you have to kind of cut it off and take the 2 ends, wrap them around the nails, and kids, don't try this without supervision, and then plug it in, a rather unexpected thing happens.
It doesn't sizzle and fry.
Well, what happens in about 6 or 7 seconds, you begin to see a little spark inside the pickle, and then a few more sparks, and then it's definitely sparkling, and then it starts sizzling, and then it starts glowing quite brightly. I mean, it's rather spectacular, especially in a dark room. And this tends to last, depending on the pickle, for 20, 30, 40 seconds. Some pickles are longer than others.
Incandescent pickles.
Incandescent pickles. And if you let it run its full course, you'll have a burnt pickle residue kind of permeating the room, which you may or may not want. But I think people have now traced back to where people have written about this or very similar things back even into the mid-1700s. So the person who really first discovered this, now that's the guy I'd like to find out what he was thinking about.
Mm. But now, this sounds like great fun, but I'm not entirely sure why one of the world's preeminent mathematicians is lighting up pickles with an extension cord.
Well, you never know what will happen until you try it, to some extent. It's a little offbeat side, but it's what keeps a lot of scientists and mathematicians alive, the curiosity, the wonder of the unknown. I mean, who would have thought that you could plug in a pickle and anything would happen? And the fact that something happens, and in fact, there's still some controversy about what it is that really is happening. It's not quite fluorescing. There's, I think, some irreversible chemical reaction going on because the pickle does wear out. But just what is going on is still a little bit more subtle than one might think. And I think that that's true in general of many things that look quite simple, that if you look into anything deeply enough, you'll see that it's a little more complicated than you might have thought.
My guest is mathematician Ronald Graham. And by the way, don't try the pickle experiment at home. You could kill yourself. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from All Things Considered. What's up on the program today, Robert?
Well, today, Frank, we have reports on the continued fighting in southern Iraq, also on the return of a soldier from the war against Iraq who came back without a scratch but then was shot and killed in the streets of his neighborhood in Detroit, and also a story about how veterans of the war in Vietnam are reacting to the return of triumphant soldiers from the war in the Persian Gulf. Also today, a report by Susan Stamberg on the poetry of Elaine Terranova and more on the case of the beatings that were meted out by members of the Los Angeles Police Department.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ron Graham is my guest. We're talking about mathematics and patterns, chaos, order, and say, as another problem, how to do handstands.
Ah, yes, handstands. Well,
you do a lot of handstands, right? Working on handstands balanced on top of a wok right now, as I gather it, a Chinese cooking
wok.
Well,
trampoline and hand balancing and juggling are all part of the same general area. Trampoline, you're juggling one object. You're the object. And handstand, you might think of a person doing a handstand or a one-arm handstand as similar to a lamp that's just standing there, not doing anything. But it's quite different from that. A handstand is dynamic in the same way that if you balance a broom upside down on your hand, you're not just holding your hand there, but you're doing something to keep the broom balanced. Well, in a handstand, you're also doing something. And it's interesting that mathematics and physics plays a more of a role than one might think. I mean, typically in a one-arm handstand, which is not such an easy trick, it takes on the order of about 2 years to learn a one-arm handstand. You have to maintain the balance, you have to keep your center of gravity and your point of support more or less lined up, because as soon as your center of gravity drifts away from your point of support, you fall over.
So if you were going to try to build a computer model of this, if you were going to put it on your screen and work out all of these movements in design, what you would discover is that what the body is doing as it learns how to do a handstand is not really developing more muscle strength, but developing the a set of coordinates, a set of which could be described by numbers in a large pattern. Is that right?
Well, it's a complicated business what the body is really learning when you learn to do a skill like that. And certainly something like hand balancing, there's a certain minimum amount of strength you need to maintain to do the things you're going to have to do. But I think a lot more important is what's going on within the brain. And you certainly see this whether you're learning trampoline tricks or tennis or juggling patterns, where you'll reach certain plateaus and you'll practice and practice and nothing is happening. And then all of a sudden, one day, it will be easy and you'll wonder what it was that was so difficult. So something is happening in the brain when you're learning these patterns and or learning these skills. And it's not clear, I think, to most performers, and I even think most psychologists don't completely agree on just how it is that you learn things at this level, because you have to go at some point from the voluntary control that you exhibit when you're doing a double somersault with a double twist or one-arm handstand or seven-ball pattern to more of a reflex where you can't think in great detail about each aspect, but it all comes together as a unified operation or unified procedure. And so that transition is somewhat mysterious, and it's a challenging problem.
Ron Graham, I looked through these various clippings, pictures of you at events. I mean, one of them in a rather serious journal has people standing at podiums or, you know, headshots, very formal, very distinguished. The photograph you've offered shows you in a one-armed handstand with your feet in the air. How do your colleagues respond to you? I mean, this is a fairly unusual way for someone of your position to present himself.
Well, my general philosophy is you shouldn't take things too seriously. You know, this is life and life only, so to speak. If you can't have a little fun, why do it? And I think that applies not just to mathematics, but kind of anything you're doing.
I mean, people don't come up to you at academic meetings and say, oh, God, here comes the juggler.
No, they typically come up and say, gee, how do you learn how to juggle? You know, I'd love to do it and impress my kids.
Ronald Graham is a researcher at Bell Labs. He also teaches mathematics at Rutgers University. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next edition of Fresh Air, we examine how the creation of Israel changed the face of the Middle East. Also, television critic David Bianculli on 10 years of public television's great performances. I'm Frank Browning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.